training it to be compassionate, like, I am curious about like what that actually will look like, because I don't know if we even have any consensus as humans about how to treat each other, right?
Yeah.
and so how do we train an AI to treat humans? I mean, that's really the thing that we're worried about.
Hello and welcome to Mindful Conversations. My name is Shamash Aladina.
I'm Calvin Niles, and we are here with Dr. Cynthia Phelps.
Wonderful to have you. Thank you so much for joining us. Cynthia was at the conference that we mentioned, I think, back in our very first episode, the Wisdom 2.0 conference this year. And she's been going on and off there for a few years. And so we got connected through there and got fascinated by her background. So great to have you here, Cynthia. Thanks so much for joining us.
And oh, it's maybe a pleasure.
And maybe just start by letting us know a little bit about your background and what you're working on.
Sure. Well, my career path has been pretty winding. I actually started out as a basic science medical researcher. My degree is in pharmacology with a focus in neuroscience. And while I was doing my postdoctoral work in neuroscience, in learning and memory, the internet happened. Browsers became interactive and very interesting. And I ended up doing a small project with a couple of friends where we developed an interactive website to teach kids about their brain. And I was hooked on technology. I was already an electrophysiologist, so I was using tech in my work in general, but the web browsers, I could just see the future, that this was the way that people were going to learn. And I pivoted my career and I started networking and writing grants in how to use emerging technologies to teach. And I ended up getting a faculty position in a school of health information. It was called Health Informatics, but the school was Health Information Science, and it was a brand new school that they were developing in the medical center in Houston, Texas. And so they brought me on because they knew I was interested in how to use technology for learning. And it was such a fun time to be working in that area. I started collaborating with our School of Public Health because I was really interested in behavior change, you know, which is a main human problem, right? Like, how do we change our behavior to be able to get what we want out of life? And I started developing online courses, and that was one of my main things that I was doing with tech at the time. And it just so happened that the Veterans Administration hired me to do this big project, and I left the university and went out as an entrepreneur developing tech for people in the mental health arena. And so I really enjoyed that. And so I've been an entrepreneur since 2009. And then so many interesting things happened. One of the main things that happened to me is I ended up with a pretty big life crisis. I had a divorce that was really painful with a lot of loss in it. And I started coping with alcohol. And so I was in this period of my life where I was just stuck and suffering deeply. And that is actually when I ran across Kristen Neff's work on self-compassion. And it was like the light from on high shone on me. And it was like, oh, well, this is what I need. And that set me off on this mindful and self-compassion journey that I have been on since around 2012. And so I like to say that I work at the intersection between technology and mental health and wellness.
Wow.
Wow.
You're the perfect person for us to talk to.
It's like, yep, we're done. We're going to meet you every week for the next 12 weeks. And we're going to explore every single topic around how technology is going to take us into a more compassionate place.
Love it. I love it. So what about AI? You talked about emerging technologies that you're interested in, and I know you're developing some apps that you could tell us about as well. Do any of those use artificial intelligence or not yet?
Well, you know, when I first started developing apps in 2011, and I already had started a company, but a startup company hired me on to be their game designer, which sounds a little off target, but actually games and game mechanics are one of the best ways that you can learn and change behavior. And so it really wasn't too far afield. And so I had an opportunity to spend a couple years designing for mobile. And so that's what kind of got me into mobile app design. But really before that, when I was faculty at UT in Houston, we were looking at all the different, like Web 2.0 was happening. So that is when microblogging, you know, Twitter, all of these things were coming into the public's use. And I actually taught classes called Emerging Technologies for Teaching and Behavior Change, where my students or graduate students were taking these new technologies and seeing how they could utilize them to, you know, really make the world a better place in the context of health science. And so, you know, I think that part of my story is important in this overall story of AI. Because I remember the excitement, and this is like in the mid-2000s, right? Where everything, all of this was emerging. It just seemed like anything was possible. You know, we were going to use Twitter to start revolutions and to do all kinds of amazing things. And, you know, I was totally one of those people that was like, technology is going to change the world for better. You know, it's going to be amazing.
And which is going to be an amazing force for good.
And, you know, fast forward to where we are now, where we're kind of digging ourselves out of these holes that we've created with some of those technologies. And, you know, we have come to understand that we have a conflict of interest when we have for-profit companies who are in charge of our behavior. It turns out we get stuck. And so I think that's an interesting thing to point out because, you know, one of the things that people are interested in right now about AI is regulation and how do we figure out how to go forward with it. You know, I'm not really a player in that conversation, but I have lived through that last wave of technology and I didn't see that coming, you know, and yeah. I like to think I'm pretty smart. And not only did I not see it coming, but we haven't figured out how to fix it yet. You know, we still have rising teen suicide, depression, anxiety. We still have, you know, adults who are stuck to devices and not thriving. And so these problems from the last wave of our technology innovation are still vexing us. And so it's really good that we're actually having some conversations about like, oh, what could go wrong this time around? Because, you know, this wave, I don't know about you, but like, I feel like, you know, the last wave was like we're a wave in the ocean and like this wave is like a tsunami. You know, it's just so much bigger in scale and impact.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for actually reflecting some of the comments that our listeners have been saying. You know, it's because you rightly point out that the opinions are very diverse. What does the future look like then? What can we do do we need to steer this ship? Do we need to take a pause as a lot of loud people are saying? Do we need to just press ahead full steam and just capitalize on the opportunities? What's the way forward? We're ready for your answers, Dr. Cynthia.
You know, I have always sat on the side of utilizing technologies as they come into use for folks, and trying to apply them to make people better, right? Either their health better, their mind better. And so I'm not certain about what folks in AI who are in on the forefront of moving AI forward, I'm really not certain what the right move is for them. It definitely has some potential to cause problems. And I think a lot of it has to do with how it's released to the public. And so it's going to be really interesting to see what they choose to do. If that, I'm skeptical of the idea of the pause, just because the reward systems that are set up just really worldwide, to be honest, it's not even just our capitalism. The reward systems wouldn't benefit like sitting back and like contemplating our role in the of AI in the world and human consciousness. And so I suspect that the pause is not going to, that they're not going to be able to execute it. And so from my perspective, one of the things that, you know, we can do is we can be thinking proactively about how not to hurt people with this technology. And, you know, there's so many different types of AI and different things that are going on right now that, you know, there's a lot of really neat potential, particularly in improving mindfulness and compassion in people with these technologies. And so, you know, my strategy is to basically work on the side of using AI for good.
Can you say a little bit more about, you mentioned behavior change a couple of times and your interest in that. How does AI impact behavior change and humans' behavior? And, you know, how is it, how do you feel it's being used at the moment? How is AI impacting our behavior every day at the moment, maybe unconsciously on our phones, for example? And then also, how do you think it could help people to be more mindful, to be more compassionate, to be more wise, perhaps?
Yes, that's an excellent question. You know, I really wasn't paying attention to AI. I had kind of shifted a lot of my focus over to my wellness business, Inner Ally. And in that business, my focus is helping people to create a more compassionate inner voice. And there's all kinds of research that supports like excellent outcomes from that, everything from physical health to mental health and wellness and so forth. So when ChatGPT came out, you know, at the beginning of the year, it created a buzz and I was like, oh, I better look at this. And when I started to play with it, I was like, oh, okay. You know, this is the first time that the AI systems have had a human interface on them that is widely accessible and it's public. And so many things kind of came together at the same time to make ChatGPT kind of blow everybody's minds, right? It's not like that technology was brand new. It's just that a lot of stuff kind of came together at once. And as soon as I saw it, I recognized the value that it might have for my work. Because largely what I had been doing with Inner Allies, I created this system, this way of creating inner compassionate language that's customized for people's core emotional needs, all based on, you know, research into that sort of thing. And what I was doing is using one-on-one coaching or using classes to walk people through this process, you know, kind of over and over until they finally get this process of where they could create their own compassionate language easily. Like they've had enough practice, right? And so when the first time I played with ChatGPT, it was like, oh, here is how I scale me, right? This is how I scale what I do with my clients. And so that's what I got really interested in immediately when I played with ChatGPT. And then I was like, I wonder what's actually happening in the space. And I started poking around the literature and I found this paper by this lab that it's like a Stanford, I think Washington University combination. And they were looking at how to use AI to improve the empathy in people's language. And specifically, they were looking at these helplines that are like text-based helplines, you know, for people who are in crisis or struggling. And what they did is they created the system where you were texting back and forth. And so like your text field is up here. And then there was actually suggestions. So you type in your response to the person who's suffering and the AI would be like, hey, you want to say it this way? Wow. And what they did is they had trained this language model to be able to generate empathetic responses. And I was like, okay, like that is practically like, it's so close to what I want to do. I was like, now I really fundamentally understand that AI can help me do what I want to do. And so that paper was really exciting for me to find. And then, you know, since then, I mean, every day something new happens in this space, right? Like you can't even keep up. But another thing, you know, there's been some smaller large language models, which seems a little oxymoronic. It's true. And one was created by Stanford, I believe. And then also Microsoft is talking about releasing Orca, which is an open source large language model. And I'm interested in both of those things because I love ChatGPT and I use it every day. But one of the things that for my purposes is I don't want people to just be able to go in and ask any open-ended question. You know, I want there to be a flow, like it's really like a guide. And so actually I can show you my system use it. It's like a character-based system. So each of the core emotional needs has kind of a archetyped character that I associated with it.
So you're holding up a set of cards. If you could just describe it for listeners.
Yeah.
You've got a set of colored cards. And what does it say on them?
Yeah, so these cards are all different characters. And each of the characters are paired with a human core emotional need. And so some of them are like acceptance, freedom, security, independence, support, power, expression.
I saw the captain and the king, so that's that must be a good sign.
There's all kinds of good ones in here.
How do people use those cards? Okay.
The lover for self-love. And so I created these guides because I felt like for myself, well, I can tell you a little story if you're down
please.
For a little story.
Yeah.
So this is 2012, like suffering greatly in addiction, right? 2013, found mindful self-compassion. And at that point, I just threw myself into it completely. I took the course. I took the teacher training. I'm getting certified as a teacher. I am in literally the last class of this process of becoming a teacher of mindful self-compassion. I have read Kristen's book. I have read every single article at the time on self-compassion, which was possible back then. You could not do that now. And I really thought I knew it all. And I'm sitting in the back of the classroom. And, you know, Kristen was actually teaching the course, which was pretty awesome. And she begins to tell this story that she actually wrote in her book. And so I had read the story. I knew the story. And she is in, I think, Trader Joe's. And she has her 10-year-old son with her, who is autistic. And he was having a bit of a meltdown. He was on the floor, kicking, screaming, red-faced. You know, the other shoppers are kind of like looking at her or their shopping carts, like, oh, you know, like, what are you doing to your child? And so she's having to have this moment for herself. And, you know, there's not much you can do to intervene in that kind of case. You're going to get kicked, right? So you just have to kind of let it go, let it ride. And so she modeled self-compassion for us in the classroom of what she did in that moment. And she stopped and she put her hand over her heart. And she said, oh, darling, I'm so sorry you're having to go through this. This is so hard. And my mind was blown because I did not have an inner compassionate voice at all. My inner voice was like at best, not nice, and at worst, like a bully, name calling and horrible. And so when I sat in that classroom and she spoke to herself like that, that was the birth of the grandmother, because she sounded to me like the avatar grandmother, like the most kind and sweet and nurturing voice. But one of the things back then, and at the time with self-compassion, is that it was largely only popular amongst basically white middle-aged women, like people look like this. And so part of why I created the Inner Allies is because I wanted it to be more accessible, more fun, have it be, you know, not gendered. And so, yeah, that was kind of the birth of the cards. And so each of the allies has a voice, they have an emotional core need that they help you support. And I give people stock language that they can start with, so you don't have to just start like, oh, okay, love yourself, say something nice.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I can see the intersection of the game experience here that you've brought in, plus the, you know, the healthcare side. And as you mentioned, you talked about the AI helping practitioners or health advisors to respond in a more empathetic way, let's say. There's actually a piece I have here, which was from neuroscience.com. It came out in April. So in ChatGPT terms, this is like biblical times. But in our terms, it's only 2 months ago. And it actually says ChatGPT beats doctors in compassion and quality of advice to patients. Researchers compared written responses from physicians and ChatGPT to real-world health questions and found that a panel of licensed healthcare professionals preferred GPT's responses 79% of the time.
You know, I remember I read that article too, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, one of the issues, you know, back to your overall question, it was like, you know, what's going on? What's the future, right? One of the things that is really clear is that we as humans, like with this hardware, right? Like we have certain things that are challenging to overcome, right? And so when I'm trying to cure you as a doctor, you know, I'm thinking about all kinds of things. I'm thinking about, you know, maybe this is going to be something that kills you. What medication? What is the dosage? You know, I have all these conversations going on in my head. And plus I'm thinking like, when am I going to eat lunch? You know, my spouse is mad at me, you know, like this is what happens in the human condition, right? And so when you're interacting with your patient, you've got like all of this nonsense happening, right? And so, you know, we are just not as clean running as computers, right? Where they're just like, they do one thing, right? And so they can provide empathetic language with no hangups, right? And I think this also stretches into behavior change as one of the big things as well, because that is something that we as humans really struggle with because we live in these bodies, right? And we have hormones and we have all of these drives to survive that are wonderful, right? They've built us and this is what makes us human, but also they can get in the way when we're trying to create world peace, you know, at the UN or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Shamash, you actually said, I remember you said to me once, someone had mentioned maybe in one of their publications that if we treat AI like a baby, we would be training it to be compassionate or to, you know, to be kind or something like
that. Yeah, Mo Gawdat in Scary Smart in his book, he saw the danger of AI and how it's going to become as intelligent as human beings and then way beyond. So the AI will become like Einstein and will be like a fly in terms of the comparison of intelligence. So he is arguing that we, at the moment, it's at the baby stage. And so we need to treat it with kindness and compassion. And just like a small child, that gives us a hope that when it grows up, it will be kind, just like a child when it becomes older and it's looking after its grandparents or something, it's compassionate. So we need, what we feed in is what we get out. Yeah. So.
Well, and that's, you know, that right there, what we feed it is what we get out is like, that's the problem, right? Because we've trained this thing like on Reddit and the internet and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, funny little, another little story. I have a dear friend who is a grief coach, and she's really all about like transformation at the point of death in a variety of ways. She's an amazing person. She happened to be going through a death of a brother in her family. And this brother was mentally ill, had brain damage, and was incarcerated and was violent and caused a lot of damage in the family. And so when he passed, she was basically the one that was in charge in her family of like putting everything together. Cause like, you know, she was the one with the skills and the empathy and the compassion and all that. And so she was a little overwhelmed and she reached out to me and said, hey, you know, I need a reading or a poem for the memorial service. And she's like, I got too much on my plate. Can you find something for me? And I was like, sure, no problem. And so the first thing I did was go to ChatGPT and I described the scenario about complex grief and, you know, and I need a poem or a reading or something. And it was really interesting because what it said back to me, it said, and I can't remember exactly the prompt I used, but it came back with a response, you're not allowed to speak poorly of the dead. And so basically it didn't understand complex grief. It didn't understand that you were allowed to have like, I guess, negative feelings or, you know, feelings of anger or frustration at someone's death. And that's very much popular culture, right? That's not the science that's has emerged. And so I thought that was really telling, right? Because that's very much what you put in is what you get out.
So, great example. Yeah. That's a really nice, clean, clear to understand example. So what happens when, I mean, this is a bit of a stretch and this is a bit of a stretch here. What happens when it starts teaching itself?
It's definitely already doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's why things have been progressing so fast is because quickly people realized you could use one large language model to train another. And so I think it's really difficult to kind of tell like what's going to happen next. You know, largely what ChatGPT does it, as a language model is it just strings text together for you, right? And so it's really just kind of a probabilistic, like what word comes after this word comes after that word. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, of course, but training it to be compassionate, like I am curious about like what that actually will look like, because I don't know if we even have any consensus as humans about how to treat each other, And so how do we train an AI to treat humans? I mean, that's really the thing that we're worried about. Like, you know, we say AI is going to be way smarter than us. Well, a lot of that smartness has to do with the fact that it has access to so much knowledge, and it has ways of being able to put that together in an instant. And so, like, that's a specific form of intelligence. And really, if you're talking about AI in general, they still call that narrow AI. And so what I think you were talking about, Smash, is that is general AI, and that doesn't exist yet. I think that is a little bit more of what people are talking about when they're like, let's put the brakes on things here. And I honestly have no idea what that's going to look like.
Wow. I want to go back to addiction, because I'm quite interested in how AI can actually be quite addictive. So, you know, a lot of the mobile apps and the social media networks, they do use AI to predict what would catch your attention. And they want us to spend as much time as possible to maximize their profits. How can us as human beings manage that addiction? Because, you talked about the suffering you went through, and you overcame your addiction using self-compassion. That was actually one of the routes out.
Yep.
But then some people are arguing that digital technologies are just as addictive potentially.
Oh, yes.
So how do we manage that addiction? What do you?
Right. Well, as someone who's slightly addicted to TikTok, I'm not really sure I'm the best person to answer that question. I think the answer is not about how humans individually can respond to a world that's set up for them to fail. Right. So what we have done with social media is the incentives for the social media companies have created a situation for all of us where we're set up to fail. We're set up to become addicted to the technologies, right? And that's by design. And this is why you'll hear, like, some social media CEOs won't let their kids play on the iPad. Like, they won't even let them use their own apps, right? And so
don't get higher on your own supply, said Biggie Smalls.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And so, you know, I think it's interesting because I studied compassion as a response to burnout. And this was actually pre-pandemic. I was looking at medical professionals. They were already having problems before the pandemic hit. And one of the things that after I studied, like, how to bring compassion to doctors and nurses and help them help themselves, one of the things I just never really went forward full bore with that as a business model, because really what needed to change was the system that they were working in.
Yeah.
Right. The system was hurting them. And so, like, you can only teach people to be so resilient. Right. And at some point you're going to have to change the system. And so I think really what I'm trying to say is we need to figure out an incentive structure in, you know, a worldwide incentive structure for AI that is not going to create the same damaging systems. And, you know, can we do that? I don't know. You know, we still haven't figured out how to not be at war.
Yeah, because I'm on openai.com right now, and it says it's got a strap line, which I don't know how long this strap line's actually been here. It actually says, creating safe AGI. Is that generative AGI?
That's still a narrow AI.
That's still narrow. Okay. That benefits all of humanity. So I mean, it's lofty. So in terms of the benefiting all of humanity, what's the compassionate response to that? Because I think of people like mindfulness teachers and other people who want to make positive, meaningful change often feel like, oh my gosh, like helpless, you know, like a sense of helplessness sometimes. There's so much going on out there that either I don't understand, so I can't participate, or I actually don't know what to do. I actually don't know, you know, okay, yes, I can put another video out of another meditation out, or, you know, write another song or poem. But the pace of change is crazy with this. What's the compassionate response to someone who actually thinks, well, benefiting all of humanity, can I even do that? I don't even know if OpenAI can do that. And they're the ones who are stimulating much of the conversation now. So what's the compassionate response in this particular time for us?
Well, my thought on that is really like what I do for myself. And so I have to remember that, you know, I'm a body with a brain, and I'm not just a brain running around the world, which, you know, I tend to forget sometimes that I have a body. And so this is why these practices are excellent for me. We have to manage our bodies to be able to thrive in our lives. And our bodies are where we feel our emotions. So if you want to feel good, if you want to feel empathy, if you want to feel someone's pain, all of that happens in our bodies. And so the way I manage things for myself is through, I have like a little system of behavior tracking for myself. It's very, very old school. I literally have a calendar on my refrigerator, and I use sparkly stars, and I track a few things. I manage a couple autoimmune diseases, and I also got a really bad concussion in 2020. And so I have to pay particular attention to my energy levels and how I'm caring for the chassis. And so on my stars are mindfulness. Like, did I do something that day that was mindful? Did I do movement, some kind of movement? Did I take care of my health in some way, like go to the doctor or set an appointment or take my supplements? And then I also track delight, which is the best that I could figure as the opposite of stress. And so if I go to lunch and have a really great conversation with a friend, or if I have a really great meeting where, you know, we're starting a new project or something like that, then I track this stuff for myself, because I know that I have a tendency to get too engaged in work. And when I do that, then I have negative repercussions physically. And so I really think, you know, and I have lots of other things going on that I have because of the autoimmune diseases that make this type of management really important and useful. But in general, I think the answer for how do people go forward is to remember that we are embodied, and that we live in the moment, and our emotions show up in the moment, and to keep bringing it back. It's like really classic mindfulness and self-compassion practices. I have been collaborating with the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion, and we just released a mobile app for that has their content in it, and that can be found at selfcompassion.app. And my company, Inner Ally, which is all about nurturing your own inner language, I'm working on putting together a mobile app that's basically augmented with AI to be able to go through this process of creating internal compassionate language for you in the moment and in response to difficult thoughts.
Okay. So how would that work? Would you put in the difficult thoughts you're going through, and it would suggest what would be more compassionate thoughts that you can say to yourself in your own mind?
Yeah, there's a whole process that I've developed. Okay. And so you can get into it in a variety of ways. One of the ways is that you can take a quiz to figure out what your core emotional needs are. And then this is basically every human has emotional needs, right? But depending on kind of how our early family life and, you know, how our life has gone, we have certain things that maybe I need to nurture more for me to be able to fully thrive. And so that is what, so you can enter in by taking this quiz and figuring out like, okay, how do I actually need to talk to myself? Like, what are the things that are important for me to be saying to myself? How do I motivate myself? Right. And so you can go from that direction, or you can come from the difficult thought direction where you enter a difficult thought and it takes you through a process of creating a compassionate thought. And so in my work, one of the things that I don't do is I don't force people to get rid of difficult thoughts. I have them hold them, you know, lightly and say, okay, this exists. And oftentimes your difficult thoughts are there because they have value. They're trying to keep you safe in some way. Like the methods are terrible usually. But then to create a compassionate thought, this helps to rewire your brain. And so really walking you through that whole process, like, does the phrase start with the I am, like a really powerful affirmation, or does it start with something softer, like, may I give myself permission to? And then how you actually think about the core need that was missing here, and then apply it here, and then just keep crafting those sentences, the internal language, and checking back in, using your body as a barometer to measure whether that phrase is working for you, and checking in with your inner critic.
Oh, what did you say? Are you still working on this app, or is it out?
Oh, yeah, no, it's in its infancy.
Okay, what's it called again, or what will the website be?
It's going to be at innerally.com.
Okay, it's going to be on that domain. Okay, we will share it hopefully in the coming months. It might come out. Definitely. Wonderful.
Yeah,
wonderful.
It'll be a little while because okay. I just started working on it at the beginning okay. of the year. Actually, I just like realized it was possible at the beginning of the year.
Well, awesome. Maybe when people go to the website, they might be able to volunteer, or they could test it out for you for the early stages once it's on, at that level.
That would be fabulous. And I'm thinking about maybe a couple of intermediary steps, like maybe yes. a web app that just utilizes a ChatGPT API. And then also I'm thinking about an Alexa app because of that verbal interface.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then when we get the Tesla robots, we can say, hey, bring me a coffee and things like that. That's the most compassionate thing that I could do for myself right about now.
Get me a coffee and give me a hug.
Exactly.
I love it. Cynthia, thank you so much, Cynthia. It's really been really great, fun really and very great. Insightful, fascinating, and
definitely.
Really beautiful work that you're working on. It. I'm excited to follow it and to see likewise. See the outcome of that. That sounds really
good. I sure appreciate the opportunity to talk about this stuff because it's one of the things that's most exciting to me right now.
Thanks for listening to our latest episode of Mindful Conversations. Join me and Calvin in the next episode as we explore this conversation together and share further insights that come up for us during our reflection. And if you like what you heard, please do leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Subscribe and maybe share with someone who would enjoy the show. Thanks a lot and bye for now.